Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Voxology Podcast. My name is Mike. This is my friend Tim.
Hi.
My very subdued friend Tim, or as some would call him, that's normal. How are you? How are you doing? We just literally got on a Zoom or a Riverside FM call. So this is our catch up right here.
This is it. I'm cruising. This is it. Friday. I'm in love.
It is. Oh, look at you, dude. You always got just a little pop culture references. Bro, I have been rocking out today to Audioslave and Alice in Chains. And I don't know. I don't know how people have grown up without grunge music.
Wait, now are you doing, like, Alice in Chains on purpose because of what today's date is? Today's the anniversary of both Layne Staley's death and Kurt Cobain's death.
Dude, I wish I were that smart. No, you caught up. Man, I've lost my Gen X card by not knowing that.
Or not. Maybe your card's just calling from the ether, somewhere in the back of your brain.
I think it is because I haven't. I mean, like, I went deep into the Alice in Chains catalog, and
they never got the credit. His voice never got.
Oh my goodness,
credit it deserved.
Yeah, he and Jerry are just ridiculous together. But I've just found it's so dumb, but I love writing sermons to, like, thick sort of rock and roll music.
Why is that dumb?
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's like you should be listening to, you know, Michael W. Smith and Amy Grant or something. I have no idea, but man, it's so good. Anyway, how was your week? Are the kids healthy? Are you well? Are you
happy? I think everybody's healthy. They're all at school right now.
Nice.
I only have 2 weeks of my semester left, so I'm in kind of crunch
time. Let's go.
Yeah.
Let's go, crunch time.
Wrap it up and then get off to a nonference.
Yes, it's coming. Woo! And you're sporting some Voxology merch today.
That's right. Which, I'm ramping up.
Hey, I'm recording, right? I'm tuning in.
Yeah.
Like, you hear everything? Because I'm not coming through in my own microphones, which, you know, is fine. I don't need to. But as long as you can hear me.
I can hear you.
Awesome. What happens, like, last week when we have a break in the YouTube channel? You edit the YouTube and you have to match it to the audio. Oh, my Lord. How long does that take?
It's not that long. I mean, it was just one long break. So I just cut that all out and kind of cross-dissolved it together, as they say.
All right.
And I used to have a little thing that popped in there that I'd put in there. It said, played like this elevator music and said, like,
oh,
we'll be right back or something like that. But I lost that
clip. Oh!
It got lost in the computer snafu.
Come on, man. But you back up stuff now.
That's right. Everything's backed up.
If our friend hears this, there better be a good report.
Time machine's running.
Yes. Anyway, friends, hello. Sorry for letting us, you know, catch up together. Tim's operating on a tight schedule. So we're just gonna dive in.
Yeah, we are.
I'm glad you're well. Glad the kids are well. You look great. Hallelujah.
Oh.
It's Friday. I'm in love. All right. So let's do a little Genesis, shall
we? Audioslave's got you pumped up.
I'm just saying. I mean, let's bring some energy today. Doggone it.
All right.
I'm tired of being Eeyore on this podcast.
Yeah.
All right. I'm gonna do my job. So we're asking the question, what does it mean to be human? And we're getting into all sorts of really great, fun, interesting stuff. We want to start talking about the word rule today. What does it mean to rule? And this could be a three-parter on one word. Because I kid you not, I can show this on YouTube. On my notes, it's page 1 of 98.
My goodness. This also felt appropriate for Easter. The Easter fell in the middle of this series.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, dude, so good. We had such a great Easter convo in our community, and we did Q&A. And the Q&A, so here's the public Q&A on Easter Sunday for the second service. It was like, what happens when we die? Why is there hell? And why is there evil? So
just the greatest hits. Like,
totally. It was like, well, let's just dive right in. Come on. Jeez. Oh my goodness. All right. So we're back. into Genesis, verse 26 of chapter 1, God said, let us make humanity in our image and our likeness so the purpose of image and likeness is so that they may rule over the fish in the sea, the birds of the sky, livestock, over our wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. That pretty much exhausts all of the modes of transportation. Then we get a poetic break in 27. So God created humanity in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them, right? And we looked at that poetic sort of refrain talking about male and female as a central part of the image. So God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth, right? Which is a command given to other animals. And then he adds the word, fill the earth and subdue it, which is the word kabosh, which is such a great Hebrew word. And then the command to rule is repeated here. So rule over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, over every creature that moves along the ground. So one thing to note is that on either side of the humanity in the image, male and female in the image, either side of that is the command to rule. So the image bearing manifests itself in ruling. Now, so this is a big word because as we've talked about, there are a number of things at play here that we don't see the human commanded to rule over the other human. We don't see God exercising power in a straightforwardly like dictatorial way. We see him just doing something very different. So we're going to talk about what the nature of the rule turns out to be. Obviously there are tons of examples of the misuse of rule. We'll talk about those in a little bit, but in order to understand why there's a command to rule and subdue, we have to understand why creation is called good, tov, and not perfect. All right. So this is a really, really, this is a big point worthy of its own podcast, which it's getting right here and now in real time, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so too long, don't read, or didn't want to read, TDLR or something, So the word good doesn't mean finished, whereas the word perfect does. So good in this sense is better than finished. The word tov is the word good. Here it is good, so it's like tov with a W in there. It can mean a number of things. It can mean pleasant, agreeable to the senses. So something is good when it is pleasant. And you can imagine a lush garden being pleasant to the senses. Yeah. It also, something could be good in comparison to others of its kind. So like the best example of something is a good example of something, for instance. It can also be good in terms of valuable, like worth something. Here, it's also used in a sense that it is appropriate and fitting, that creation is appropriate to what God intended for it. So it matches God's intention. Now, the reason we know that the word good doesn't mean perfect here is because of what God loads creation with. So earlier in chapter 1, we read this, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it according to their various kinds. So the land produces vegetation, and what's the vegetation produce?
Seeds.
Which produces what?
Vegetation.
More vegetation, exactly. or it says, and it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. God saw that it was good. In other words, God is loading this thing with potential. It's not all a realized potential. So in the same way that the humans can fill the earth and make more humans, the plants, the trees can like reproduce in that way so that more vegetation is coming. He loads it with potential. He's creating things that can create more things. Right. So we see this with the animals, too, in verse 21 of chapter one. God created the great creatures of the sea and every living thing which the water teems and that moves about in it according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the water in the seas. So he's loaded creation with the ability to make more of itself. Hmm. Right? So that means on its own, creation is going somewhere.
Yeah.
And all you need to do is look at your backyard, if you have a backyard, to see that that's true. Right? It doesn't take very long.
Especially right now.
For creation. Note, Tim just looked out at his backyard.
That's right.
It doesn't take very long for nature to sort of reclaim the human spaces that are cultivated and, you know, precise. Right.
I love it when trees bust up sidewalks and stuff. They're like, hey, nice work there, guy.
Yeah. Good try. So creation is going somewhere. And so the reason there has to be a command to rule and subdue is because left to itself, creation is going to explode and just make more and more and more of itself. And so what God does is he places these image bearers in such an environment that's going somewhere so that they will take it, cultivate it, direct it, manage it, right? I mean, it's and that is the entire human enterprise. Like, there isn't one part of human life where we're not creating or managing or stewarding or, you know, directing creation in one way or another, right? In the way that we eat, in the way that we drink, in the way that we play. I mean, we're always doing this. And so when we say perfect, the word perfect connotates complete or static, something that's finished and that all you can do is screw up, right? So creation, right? I mean, seriously, like growing up, we had a room in our house that was the white furniture room.
Oh, no.
We were only allowed in it like the high priest on one day of the year, Christmas Day, and only with appropriate sacrifices, namely clean clothes. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that the room, the white room, existed in perfection. And the only thing you could do, the only option, was screwing it up.
Have you talked about this in therapy yet?
No, but it's a perfect metaphor for something. Yeah. Absolutely. And so if you start with the idea that creation is perfect, then of course the man and the woman and the rest of the tribe screws it up, because that's the only direction it can go. But if you start with it loaded with potential, then the question becomes, what will they do with it?
Yeah.
And it can be directed to good or to bad, but that's not preset, right? If it's perfect, the only way they either are going to maintain it or they're going to screw it up. Those are the only two options.
Right.
If it's good, then their work and their intention and their choice actually matters in the direction the whole project is to go. And so image bearing, the way that God envisions humans as having real power, authority, and agency in the world, only makes sense if the world then is something that is still impressionable or influenceable or directable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you're not ruling over a finished.
Exactly.
Look at me.
Yeah, well, that I've always understood the Eden story as God's finished, completed work that the humans then come and screw up, rather than the real opportunity the humans had to do what they were made to do.
Yeah,
which was to direct it in God honoring and creation benefiting kind of ways. And so it's a huge, and I want to make sure I do it justice, it's a huge theological point that creation is good and not perfect. Creation is waiting to be taken somewhere. Creation is loaded with potential that is meant to be exploited. Our kids are not coming into a world, even now under the curse, are not coming into a world that is that sits in either direction, good or finished bad. It sits still loaded, waiting for them to engage their power and agency and authority to take it, you know, someplace or another. Makes sense so far?
Yes.
It's such a big deal. And good, and it's funny because God, we get glimpses, very poetic glimpses into how God feels about creation. And good in the sense of pleasing is like at the forefront of these descriptions. So I want to read a little bit from the book of Job and just ask the question, so how does God feel about things? Because every now and again, you know, I'll watch a nature documentary, or there'll be something on TV where they'll show a fish that has existed at the bottom of the deepest oceans that's never seen sunlight and that no human eye has ever seen. And it just looks weird and funky. And you're like, oh, well, that's cool. And you kind of realize that God has been enjoying that fish forever, right? Like for however long time has existed, he's been enjoying that fish. There's no shock or surprise. And so Job 38, God, you know, shows up finally to answer Job's questions. And he vindicates Job, but he also kind of says, hey, just for the record, is there a way that you can explain the physical realm? Oh, you can't? Well, maybe trust me for the rest of it. So he says to Job, where were you, Job, when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you know. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set, or who laid its cornerstones? While the morning stars sang together and the angels shouted with joy. And you just, it's just like, I don't know. I mean, if the spiritual beings were observing this, joy would be a pretty appropriate word to describe what the reaction must have been.
Yeah. God also has sarcasm.
Oh, wait till we get to the ostrich. Just wait till we get to the ostrich. It's so good. So God, he keeps going on for a whole chapter. This is later in the same chapter. He's like, can you bind the beauty of the Pleiades? And I don't know if that's a constellation. I think it is. Can you loosen Orion's belt? I know that is a constellation. Can you bring forth the constellations in their eternal seasons, or lead the bear out with its cubs? Do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you set up God's dominion over the earth? Can you raise your voice to the clouds, cover yourself with a flood of water? Who gives the ibis wisdom, or the rooster understanding? I mean, I love that. And in chapter 39, he talks about the wild donkey. He loves the wild donkey as opposed to the like domesticated donkey. He says, who let the wild donkey go free? Who untied its ropes? I gave it the wasteland, its home, the salt flats, its habitat. It laughs at the commotion in the town. It does not hear a driver shout. There are no drivers corralling the wild donkeys. It ranges the hills for pasture and searches for any green thing. I mean, it's like this. God's enjoyment of something is reason enough for its existence. There can be no other like you don't have to give another reason for something to exist other than God just delights.
Well, I remember this. One of my favorite pieces of scripture is, it's very short, but it's in early Genesis, in talking about God walking through the garden in the evening or something.
Cool of the day. Yeah.
Where it's just like, what a beautiful image that is. And it does show that kind of idea too, that he's just like, oh, this is cool. And he's just going to take a walk through it. And you get a sense of like slowness and appreciation. And
well, here's what's really cool. So walking in the garden at the cool of the day. So walking garden, cool of the day, that triplicate or walking sound of the Lord in the cool of the day, that triplicate is only found one other place. And that's when God appears on Mount Sinai.
Oh, interesting.
In thunder and lightning. So it's probably not calm. Hmm. It's probably like pretty epic.
But the fact that he wants to, he's just putting
on the Ritz. Yes. Our God is an awesome God. There's thunder in his footsteps and lightning in his fists. There is no Timothy. That's incredible. And there is no greater juxtaposition between the greatness of a chorus and the awfulness of a verse than that song.
Yeah.
God bless Rich Mullins. Now, central to be human is enjoying creation.
What? Get out of the gift shop.
What? Yes. Not just doing something with it, but enjoying it. Right? And we do this all the time. We can't help. I mean, we take pictures of everything. Mm-hmm. We can't help when we see something beautiful to want to share it with somebody else. I mean, absolutely. So God making things good, not perfect, is massive to understanding what rule is and why ruling is needed.
Yeah.
But also the sitting behind God's creation of things is God's enjoyment, and that God created things to be enjoyed. So I love this about the ostrich. Talk about sarcasm. I love it. The wings of the ostrich flap joyfully, though they cannot compare with the wings and feathers of the stork. She lays her eggs on the ground and lets them warm in the sand, unmindful that a foot may crush them or some wild animal may trample them. So not very smart. She treats her young harshly as if they were not hers. She cares not that her labor was in vain. For God did not endow her with wisdom or give her a share of good sense. Yet when she spreads her feathers to run, she laughs at the horse and the rider. So let's talk about the ostrich. And this is to Job. Job, consider the wild donkey. And consider the ostrich. Ostrich is dumb AF and yet runs fast. I love it. This is just God sort of like poetically pointing out, look at all this. This is incredible.
You ever seen a platypus?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So God says, let the land produce stuff. Let the animals produce more animals. Let the humans produce more humans. And I'm going to place image bearers to direct and guide and rule and subdue and manage and caretake all of this some direction. And in that way, we imitate him, right? Mm-hmm. That he directs, caretakes, manages. Now, the difference, of course, is the word for create that's used of God can mean create from nothing. You and I can only create using things that already exist. But we're imitating nevertheless. That's part of what imaging is, right? So the need for rule is tied to the fact that creation is loaded with potential. It's not static and perfect. And the intention of creation is that it should be enjoyed, right? There's this incredible verse in 1 Timothy where we're beginning later stages of the New Testament to see something called proto-Gnosticism. Proto just means like the earliest form, the embryonic form of Gnostic thought. And it's the idea that there is a separation between the spiritual and the physical, that the spiritual is good and the physical is bad. And so it was thought, you know, later on by the Gnostics that Jesus could not have come in human flesh because he, a pure spirit, could not live in flesh, and flesh by definition is polluted.
Yeah.
And we still suffer under Gnostic tendencies in evangelical Christianity. Oh, yeah. It's the idea that there is spiritual and non-spiritual activities are sacred and secular or whatever. And one of the things we need to talk about is what it means to be embodied, because in my religious upbringing, embodiedness was never really talked about other than don't listen to your body. And I'm not saying it's a good idea to just listen to your body, but I was given no other instruction other than just don't.
Yeah.
Now, 1 Timothy has this incredible line. Excuse me, it's a paragraph. It's correcting false teaching. The Spirit clearly says that in later times, some will abandon the faith and follow deceiving spirits and things taught by demons. Okay, that's a very strong. What is the nature of this demonic teaching? Such teachings come through hypocritical liars whose consciences have been seared as with a hot iron. Ooh, okay. So we have demons inspiring hypocritical liars. But what are they teaching? They forbid people to marry and order them to abstain from certain foods, which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and who know the truth. For everything God created is good. And nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving because it is consecrated by the word of God in prayer. Everything God created is good. And so there's this sense of why wouldn't you get married? That's part of a good creation. Why wouldn't you enjoy foods? That's part of God's good creation, right? And obviously we can abuse all of this. And the Bible is full of that too, because immediately in chapter 4, we meet two sons. One of them is a farmer who cultivates the land, and one of them grows or manages a herd of livestock. And the two come into conflict when they both offer something from their choice of vocations. One is received, the other is rejected. The one who's rejected murders the one whose offering is received. But immediately you see culture making happening, right? Mm-hmm. That people are taking it somewhere. So here's land. So we're going to cultivate it, or we're going to harvest crops, or we're going to have livestock on it. So, you know, we also see this in Genesis chapter 11, where we see the progression from like uncut stone to now bricks and tar for mortar. And so, you know, this is evidently, this was big technological advance in the, you know, in the day.
Look at Bob over there. Bob's building bricks again. Look at him.
Yeah, we got bricks, baby. We got bricks. And so what do they do? So the sin isn't that the humans are being exercising their power and agency. Yeah. Exactly. The sin is that they're doing it in ways that do not align to the purposes of God in creation, to the enjoyment of other humans, to the benefit, to the benefit of all of creation, and to kind of the Godward direction that all creation was to be focused.
Yeah.
So, and do we still, like, with every bit of technology coming down the pike, whether it's AI or whether it's
nailed it, we're in a good spot. Yeah.
Totally. And one of the things that's really, really interesting is, you know, we covered in our Revelation series, the idea that the story ends with this same picture, the humans ruling. So Revelation 22, the angel showed me the river of the water of life as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life. We met that in Genesis, of course, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be any curse. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city. His servants will serve him. They will see his face. His name will be on their foreheads. There will be no more night. There will not need the light of a lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord God will give them light, and they will reign forever and ever. Again, we're going to see next week that rule is a royal word. It's a kingly word in the ancient Near East. And so here we get a version of the word, that word reign. And so the story begins and ends with image bearers doing image bearer things, namely ruling and reigning over restored creation at the end, but the initial creation in the beginning. Just a couple of quotes, and I'd love your thoughts on some of this. This is from James K.A. Smith. When God calls creation into being, he announces that it is very good, but he doesn't announce that it's finished. Creation doesn't come into existence ready-made with schools, art museums, and farms. Those are all begging to be unpacked. But unfurling that potential is going to take a lot of work. That work is the labor of culture, of cultivation, of unpacking. Indeed, creation is itself a call and an invitation. The riches and potential of God's good creation are entrusted to his image bearers. That is our calling and commission. Or Michael Goheen says it this way. Creating something good by cultivating God's world is called culture making, and it's an important part of the human vocation. When we discover and unfold the inherent goodness in the things that we make, we fill the world with things that evoke awe and wonder. And our work becomes a magnifying glass that provides a clear picture of God's majestic creation. When humans experience wonder and delight as they encounter good culture, whether it's a symphony, a baseball game, or a sandwich, they are experiencing an amplified image of God's good handiwork. Our work can give people a glimpse of the majesty of God's creation and a sense that there is something greater than themselves in the world. Now, this is the basis of art and the basis of sport and the basis, I mean, of almost everything humans do. Because God's enjoyment of something is reason enough for its existence. Human, in the best sense of the word, enjoyment of something is enough of a reason for it to exist. In other words, humans are not constrained just by agriculture and, you know, livestock and productivity, but when they produce things that are good in the sense of pleasing, they're imitating their creator who creates things that are good in the sense that they are pleasing too. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So the vocation is like almost, it's got so many layers to it. God, the first step is that God creates and loads creation with potential, but God enjoys what he makes and his enjoyment of it spills over. Likewise, we take the potential of creation and direct it, and then our enjoyment of what's been made imitates and echoes the divine decree that it is good. Now, of course, in our warped and twisted selves, there are things that we enjoy that aren't good.
Yeah.
Totally understand that. But there is something beautiful that all culture appreciates when we stand at the foot of a 1,000-year-old redwood tree, or at the base of the pyramids in Egypt, or watching a gentle downpour through a lush garden. I mean, there's just something that's universal in that. And so the justification for art isn't, hey, people will like it. It's enough that if I do, it's enough if I like it.
Yeah.
Image bearing. What?
That's so much of my therapy.
Right.
Is that very thing.
Exactly right. Art for its own sake is a sacred task. It doesn't have to sell well. Like, and I've heard artists say this, like, write for yourself and whatever. And there, and you know, I think we'd all love to be paid what we think we're worth for the stuff that we create, for sure. Timothy, let the reader understand, or the hearer understand, that Timothy just raised his hand.
That's correct.
But there's a sense in which that the enjoyment of something, of some created good, is central to being human. And something is missing when we restrict spiritual and Jesus stamped things to only those things that are explicitly Christian.
We restrict or pervert. And there's like the two ends of the spectrum there with the, you know, obviously the easy ones are like how good sex is, and then what things like pornography do to that.
Exactly. 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 Exactly.
But I was talking to someone yesterday about this very thing. Cause I was in a meeting last night, and we were talking about something having to do with youth, but I was talking about skiing and how God made these beautiful weather systems, how beautiful snow is, and it falls on the mountains.
Unless it's like, in April.
Which it did here snow yesterday. It is 36 degrees and raining right now. But you drive to the mountains and it's just the most beautiful thing when there's a fresh snow, and it's just this beautiful cycle, blah, blah, blah. And then humans come up with this idea to build these smooth sticks to put on our feet and ride down the mountain. And it's so fun, and you're enjoying the beauty, and you're caught up in this whole thing. And I think about God being like, he didn't invent skis, but he made snow and these beautiful weather systems that he's like, oh, this is so amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we do this cool thing with it. And I feel like God's like, oh, that's a pretty cool idea.
Yeah.
I think we have a lot of things like that, that God's like, oh yeah, you guys have kind of like took this thing and you made it something new, or added this little thing to it that, you know, enables us to enjoy. And then when you go skiing and you just see everybody smiling, it's just this great, beautiful thing that's good for you. It's good exercise. You're outside. It's beautiful.
We start with a God very often in Christian theology who is disappointed and stingy.
Yes.
And he's and pissed angry, because we screwed this thing up, and darn it, guys, I gave you all this and this is what you did with the place.
Yeah.
And obviously there's an element of truth to that. Like we have brought corruption.
Yes.
Absolutely. But that's a reflection on us, on what God is like in God's self and his essential self.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, Genesis 1 just paints this picture of a God who is abundant and lavish and funny and like does things because humans enjoy them. I mean, of all the ways to reproduce, we could have grown babies and gardens, but
laid
eggs. But to make it this sort of fun and all encompassing, I mean, you just get a picture of a God who comes like Jesus does, who's funny and who enjoys things and who laughs and obviously grieves and is angry. Yes, yes, yes. But so often the Christian story starts with those notes and not, dude, consider the freaking donkey, the wild donkey. Like the other donkeys in the town.
I'm going to give you two examples right now, a wild donkey yeah. and an ostrich.
Yes. And they're both dumb in their own way. So
just
Job,
like you,
suck on that. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's just, it's borderline just nonsense that those are the examples, but I think that's the profundity of the point, right? Is that if joy is found there, then where else? You know, then it can be found anywhere else. And again, this doesn't mitigate the injustice, the evil, the powers, the principalities, death, sin, the whole thing.
No, but it helps illustrate why those are left turns.
Yes. And not God's intentions from the start. And even then Paul will say, you know, God created things for our enjoyment. Like, so yes, there are things we have to avoid. That's the process of discernment. There are things that I want to enjoy that aren't good for me, for others, for my relationship with God, whatever else, granted. But I don't look at God. I fundamentally look at God as a restrictor of fun rather than the author of the whole idea itself. Right. And so Genesis, if you just had Genesis 1, you would be going, I mean, this is, and it's so different from the other Near Eastern creation stories that are all birthed out of violence, most mm-hmm. of them. And humans are created either out of that violence or as slaves to the gods.
Yep.
And here you get a picture of a God who wants people to live in his house. And it's just like, man, guys, I built this house and it's like all you can eat. Like, and there's no cost to this thing, right? And I want you to do something with it. It's unfinished. And I know you guys are loaded with creativity and ideas and ingenuity and curiosity and humility, like take it and enjoy it. I mean, what a picture. And so what do you think gets restored in Christ? It's that. It's the enjoyment, even in the midst of sin and death, of leaves and bees and flowers. And obviously, you don't have to be a Jesus follower to enjoy those things. That just echoes, those are echoes of image bearing. Absolutely.
That's
but there
whole...
is a sense...
tangent too.
It is. But there's a sense in which if you come across Jesus followers who are sour and all they do is critique and they're angry and they're disappointed, they're just imaging the God they think is there.
Yeah.
And I've been around Jesus followers who are so full of joy and delight and playfulness. And they're imaging what I think is the real picture and authoritative picture of what God's actually like. When God is within God's self, this is what God is like: playful. Consider the freaking ostrich, dumb,
but dumb,
man,
but happy.
Wave at the horse. Yeah, exactly, exactly. So, this isn't. I mean, I thought about making this the first point of a very long podcast, but I thought it was worthy of its own emphasis because what does rule mean? Rule means the work's not done. That there's still stuff to do. And you and I,
let's talk about, can we talk about implications then, since we have a few minutes? Like,
yeah, yeah.
Because Easter was largely, or part of the conversation is this invitation into restoration. And it seems like that's partly what we're talking about here is now we are still being invited into this ruling thing, but a lot of it is restoring or redirecting or like exposing mm-hmm. what the actual pieces are. So in class we were talking, I have a bunch of students writing about nutrition for their last argumentative essays. And so we're having lots of conversations about why is America the one place where so much of our food is illegal in other countries because it's so bad. So like Doritos and things like that are outlawed in other countries because they're just like poison. But there's something about American our idea of what freedom means is that we should be able to choose to eat that kind of stuff if we want to. So even like one of the examples was like McDonald's in France serves much higher quality food than McDonald's here. It's the same company, but our restrictions are so much lower that we just have so much food that's just terrible for us, but we consider it part of our right. Americans have a really weird relationship with freedom. So then I started thinking about how does that carry over into our theology, this weird idea of freedom and what we think. Sometimes we think that just the ability to have something is good, not that it is inherently good.
That makes sense. And that totally makes sense.
It makes a really weird dichotomy that we all exist in. And so even in that sense, like inviting like a restoration of diet, which sounds dumb, but it's like, you know what I mean? It's a small little kernel of an example of what that looks like. Or we were talking about environmental issues and why do Christians not lead that conversation?
Yeah. That's part of next week.
It's so interesting.
Yeah.
So I'll put a pin in that then, but there's a lot of like things like that, that I think are really, and because then I went to therapy after class and then was talking about, we're spending a lot of time on shame and false guilt. Cause I carry a lot of that and how to recognize something that is true guilt and learn and grow and turn from it and rectify whatever that is. But then false guilt and shame is something I carry really heavily. So she's helping me determine what does that look like and how does that look like? But the stuff you're talking about, like the church has for a long time operated, like we've said, starting in the third chapter of Genesis forward. And even the way we relate to what is good is out of shame and not out of like what you're describing here. Like just this plentiful, joyful, beautiful, wonderful thing that we can.
Yep.
That we're being asked to
enjoy.
Yeah. And so it's like we have such a weird shame thing with enjoyment for some obvious reasons, but it's like it kind of starts there for some reason with us. And then we have to unravel it or get rid. I don't know, but it's frustrating. But I really like, I think in the middle there, you said that even creation itself is invitational.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's.
Well, it just sits there. I mean, nobody looks at maybe adults do, but no kid looks at sand and ocean and goes, I can't think of anything to do here.
No, my kids just went to San Diego for spring break and they were with my wife's brother and he took them surfing. My son came back and he's like, I have to know, are there colleges in San Diego? And we're like, oh yeah, there's a ton. He's like, I have to find what majors are there because I have to surf. He's just like, he's obsessed now. Totally. And the ocean is just one of those things. Like I never really learned to swim. And so I have like a really awe-inspired, fearful relationship with the ocean. And it endlessly inspires me, but it also is terrible and, you know, threatening and big and all those things. But last thing with that is that, you know, as we've talked about, my therapist will often encourage me to go outside when I am like peak anxiety or feeling depressed or whatever. There's something, nature itself is restorative, just being in it.
Yeah.
Like, and so when you're reading through all those passages, I think about that. I think about like what it is to go breathe fresh air, what it's like to go hike down to the river by my house and just be by this mighty water that's running and amongst all these big trees. And there's something about that that inspires my humanity in a great way. And that's a very simple, that's just going out and being in it. I'm not doing anything other than letting it exist around me or exist within it. And it cultivates that kind of stuff. So it's just, I don't know. I think this is such a wonderful thing.
It is. It means enjoyment is a spiritual discipline.
Yeah. Oh man.
Enjoying something.
Yeah.
Like I'm going to enjoy a great meal with friends. Mm-hmm. I'm going to enjoy some music. Like just hearing, I mean, the genius that it took God to create ears that reflect sound and a brain that can remember music and groove to it and bodies that move. I mean, I just never want to lose that. I never want to lose. And that's where Seth is so great because, you know, Seth, it's just all new and fresh. It's just, it's awesome. And I want to be like that. You know what I mean? Yeah. Every spring, I want to marvel at the buds on all of the trees that are around here.
You were doing that yesterday. And all the trees are blooming. And it's just like
I just think that's a fundamental part of the restoration of our humanity.
There's so much theology in that too. Like during one of the Wanderer episodes, I was reading passages from this book about trees. and nice. How trees, how they take care of one another in a grove, and how they their roots connect, how they commune with each other, how when one tree is sick, they will dump their own vitamins into the soil to help that tree out. When a tree falls, it still will push its nutrients to other trees within the area. It's like, and that's what, it's just, it's a really beautiful metaphor for how they exist and how they take care of each other. And
yeah. Yep. Yep. And it
can inspire your humanity.
Yep. So friends, your assignment today is get outside.
Get outside.
And enjoy something. Anyway, this was great. Short and sweet today. And we'll next week, I want to talk to you, Tim, about Gombas. He's available next week if we want to have him a couple of times. So let's talk about that. And we can talk about ruling more and whatever else. So we got loads to cover, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in. It is a great privilege, seriously, to be a small part of your life. Have a great rest of your day. Bye.
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 Thank you, thank you, thank you for listening to this conversation. The Voxology Podcast is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that is made possible by listeners just like you. If you'd like to partner with us, you can do so at patreon.com/voxologypodcast or on Tithe.ly, tithe.ly, search Voxology Podcast. You can interact with the hosts on Facebook/Voxology Podcast or on Instagram @Voxology Podcast and on Twitter or X, whatever it is, @MikeErie. Thank you, thank you, thank you for walking this long road with us.